Greetings, this is Reverend Juliet Nightingale, and welcome to this transmission of Toward the Light, Leading Back to the Source. This is a program centered on the nature of consciousness and life continuum as revealed through near-death, out-of-body, and similar spiritually transformative experiences. Some of the topics include what people should know about the dying process, the many facets of after-death communications, living interdimensionally and being multisensory, intuition and telepathy, and more. We feature special guests who are both experiencers and researchers in the realm of NDEs and related topics. For more information about our organization Toward the Light, the services, support, and resources that we offer, please visit our website, towardthelight.org, and our media site, towardthelight.info. This week I'm very pleased to have back an old friend and one of the original, and I do mean original, researchers in the field of near-death studies, P.M.H. Atwater. Welcome, P.M.H., to Toward the Light.
Well, it's good to be here.
It's always so wonderful having you on the show, and I'm really excited to speak with you about your revised edition of Coming Back to Life, which was your first book, and that really was the huge launching of NDE research, especially for you. And I know that this must have been very, very, challenging and indeed a very powerful, I'd say, catapult as a result of your having had your three near-death experiences. You, unlike so many of us, were immediately pushed, as it were, into the study, the research of NDEs. Now, would that in part be the fact that your father was a policeman? What actually compelled you, other than the fact that you were probably given this assignment from the other side, as a lot of us are?
I was given this assignment in my third near-death experience.
Okay.
You know, like so many of us, I reached the realm, what we in research call the realm of all-knowing, where all the puzzle pieces of life are answered, your questions are answered. A lot of revelations are given. I happen to be one of those that could bring it back. Most are not able to. I was able to bring it back in detail. A lot of those revelations are in my book, Future Memory.
Yes.
But in my third near-death experience, after I had that revelatory part and witnessing part and observational part, then a voice spoke. And it was not like any voice I'd ever heard before. And I think it's significant to say that before I died, which was in 1977, I had been sort of head over heels and knee-deep into research of altered states of consciousness, psychic phenomena, mysticism, all these kinds of things. So I was very familiar with angels and guides and guardians and, you know, the various kinds of beings and voices you can hear on the other side or that you tend to contact in otherworldly or spiritual experiences. So I was familiar with all that. No, this voice wasn't like that. This voice was so powerful, so huge, I don't have words at all to describe this voice. So I call it the voice like none other, because it was like none other. And my sense was it was of God. But all I can call it is the voice like none other. And it spoke very few words. And it said, quote, test revelation. You are to do the research. One book for each death. Then it showed me what that meant. It showed me what was to be in each book. It did not tell me how to do the work or how long it would take me. I am literally alive today because I was to do the research I did. And I came back with that reality. I came back with that truth. And I have been doing that work now for 30 years. And I have been doing it with a passion and a vigor that is unending, because my life, my world, my head, my brain, my body is filled with that voice. And there was I mean, there was no, I didn't choose to do this work. I came back to do this work. That was my calling.
Yeah.
It wasn't a choice, it was a calling. And that's what I have done, like I said, for 30 years without question. A lot of people talk about all the books I have written. I've certainly written more than three. The first book was not named. The second and third were. The first book was to have been Coming Back to Life. The one that is now reprinted. But it is not Coming Back to Life because of all of the things that happened to that book, which we can talk about later if you wish. And about, some years later, I wrote Beyond the Light. So I consider Coming Back to Life to be prelude to the trilogy and Beyond the Light to be book one. Future Memory is book two. That was named by the other side. The third book was also named. It's a particular Emmanuel. It's about a fourth done. I do not know if I'll ever finish it. I have no idea. I've written a lot of books since. At no time did I ever choose to write a book. Never. Not once. Not one time did I ever choose to write a book. Each of the books came to me. It came to me in a trail of sparkles and dropped in my lap. This is not something that I was aware of or was praying for or conscious of. It simply happened. And it was always a surprise. And then I did, play with it. Gee, this is an interesting idea. And I do an outline, match it to what I have done in the way of research. Can I really write this book? Am I able to write this book? And several of my books I did not feel I was able to write. But I put my trust in that voice, and I put my trust in those sparkly bits of energy, and like little stars. And each of the books were written many, many times. When I was writing the books, I would have no idea what word to use. And the word would just come to me, and I'd have to stop everything and pull out the dictionary and look up the word in the dictionary, because I had no idea what that word was. And,
the book wrote you, in a manner of speaking.
Yeah, in a manner of speaking, they did indeed.
You know, I was really noting how much we've got in common with regards to our experiences and then our being catapulted into doing research and sharing this with the world, because I too was told I had to come back specifically to fulfill this calling to spread the word that life is eternal. But the difference is, and it is somewhat of a huge difference, is that you went into this straight away, just a year after your near-death episodes, where I didn't have my coming out, as it were, until 97, when I found out about IANS, and then really the beginning of this decade that I started coming out, and I guess things like this radio show and articles that I write are my version of the books. But it's very
well.
Powerful.
You've done great work, Juliet, and I certainly congratulate you for that and honor you for that. I think you've done an incredible job.
Oh, bless you, my dear. Well, again, like you, we've really got no choice. Like you, I'm here only because I've been sent back to do this work, and I still marvel. In fact, the past couple of days I've been marveling that I am still actually alive, when it's been pretty treacherous lately.
Yes, it has. You've not been in the best of health.
No, and yet, when spirit or that voice compels us to do this work, we're not going to be allowed to go home until we've completed the work. And what's interesting to me is that article that you wrote that you sent to me and the rest of your group about when you first started doing this work, and people were, for lack of a better word, ridiculing you or jumping on you and referring to or regarding you as being an error. And I thought to myself, nothing could be further from the truth.
Well, that's a nice diplomatic way of saying I was fried for writing that book. And I really was. Yes, it did not come out to good company. I was prepared at the time for maybe the religious community to be against what I was writing, the fundamentalist community, you know, different people in the public to object to coming back to life. But I didn't have any problems with, you know, those folk at all. No problem at all with the fundamentalist people or the religious people or so forth and so on. No,
so you didn't
no problem.
This is of the devil or...
No, I had none. I didn't have any problem with that.
Wow, that's unique.
My problem was with my peer group. And that's where the attacks came from. Not from the public at large. And that I was not prepared for. The people I loved the most were, in many cases, the people who turned against me. So, you know, that's an interesting lesson. Hard at the time.
Yes.
But it has proved to be a good one, you know. And until you have walked on the dark side, I don't think you can really know what life is.
That's a very good point, Madeira. I think that's such a tremendously good point. And, in fact, some people have pointed out that our worst nightmares that we experience are our greatest gifts for that very reason. That in order to understand what the light is, we need to understand what it isn't.
Well, you know, the question always is, can you handle the shadows light brings?
Yes.
And that, you know, that's a good one, and it's true. It's absolutely true, and it's an opportunity I had to go through that. It was not comfortable at the time, but I would not allow... Well, I almost gave in. After 7 years of attacks against me, I got to the point where I reached a very, very deep depression. I really did. What one whole winter, all I could do was cry. And at the end of that winter, when I came out of this depression, there was no big revelation. There was no word said from the other side. There was no inspiration at all. There was just that inner knowing to do more and work harder. That's all I came out of it with. Do more and work harder. And so I did. I sort of turned the world off, as it were. Not completely, but sort of. And didn't listen anymore to anybody else. Didn't pay any attention anymore to anybody else. And I just simply did more and work harder.
Now, what
and from that came book after book after book. And a lot more research. And testing of my research. And cross-checking my work. And now today, my work is standing up, or some of it is at least, to... clinical prospective studies. And I am in The Lancet. One of my findings was upheld and verified in the Big Dutch study. So I'm in The Lancet, and so is Coming Back to Life.
Yes.
They're mentioned in The Lancet.
Now, would you say that maybe because of that assignment that filled you with conviction, as it were, would you say that it was that that enabled you to ultimately be undaunted and to follow through with it?
Well, I would add to that the energy of the assignment.
Yes.
I would not just say the assignment. I truly feel that I was in God's presence in my third near-death experience. I truly feel that. In fact, I have no doubt about that.
Mm.
And that presence, that energy, that power, that passion, is what fueled me.
Yeah.
And I worked, you know, I worked on the average of 8 to 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. After about 20, 25 years of that, I allowed myself to work a five and a half day week. And maybe 7 to 8 hours a day. So I was kind to myself. But, to me, it was never a decision.
Yeah.
I just simply never made a decision. It just, that's the way it was, and that's what I did, and I never looked back. It's only been the last couple of years that I've looked back. And when Coming Back to Life came out, it only came out a few weeks ago, And yes, you can get it from any bookstore. You can get it from my website. You can get it from Amazon.com. And if you don't know my website, it's www.pmhatwater.com. One word, lowercase, pmhatwater.com. And I do have a bookstore on my website now. Didn't used to, but I do now. And so if you want an autographed copy, you get it from me. And if you want to save yourself a little money, you get it from Amazon.com. Or you should be able to get it from any bookstore. But when that book came out, I've got to admit to you, I just don't know quite what to do with it. And just touching the book, just holding the book gives me goosebumps.
Oh, sure.
Because there's so much connected with that book. And with all of the pain and trauma that I went through in, with the book coming out, and not being accepted in with the groups and the people that you thought it would be accepted from. Overlaid on top of that was the fact that I got caught in our nation's first major takeover of an old-line New York publishing company by a corporate raider. And the book had sold out two printings. It was on its way to a third printing, and everybody thought it would be a bestseller. And I was doing a lot of major television at that time when this occurred. And he bankrupted the company, and I almost lost my shirt as well. And there was just, well, it took my husband and I 9 years to pay off the debt of what happened because of that fiasco. And add to that, on top of that, I was really naked in that book. I talked about my own near-death experience in Chapter 2. I talked about some of the things I went through in the way of handling the after effects. So in that sense, it's more personal than a lot of my other books. But it is a research book. I mean, don't think that it's just my story. It is not. Never was. My story is part of the book, but that book is not my story. But the idea of, you know, all the things I went through and all the stuff, and, yeah, it's like, you know, I talk about everybody else's story, not my story. And it's been kind of embarrassing, and, you know, it's been kind of like a big deal for me, maybe not for anybody else, but for me. And, you know, it's just so much is tied up in that book. And to realize it's back now for another run, it's like, gulp, gulp, but also, yay, yay. There were some incredibly good things that happened from that book. First of all, we have our townhouse where we live today because of that book. My husband, Terry and I, did not have a great enough, big enough income to buy a house, townhouse, anything else. Just no way. We didn't have it. But we went ahead anyway and bid on this house and townhouse, small townhouse, and the people that lived here took it, and we applied for financing, and the broker was very up front with us from the very beginning. He says 50-50. He says, I don't know. In fact, he says, I would really say it's 60-40. Probably a 60% chance this loan's not going to go through. So my sister was with me at the time, and she being a very proper nurse, you know, and very, very smart in her business, told me point blank, she said, there is no way you're going to get a mortgage. There's no way you can qualify. It just is not possible. Well, we got it. And a month later, the broker met us saw us at a restaurant and came over and said, did I ever tell you the story of how you got your mortgage? How you got approved? I said, no. Tell us the story. It happened in Richmond, Virginia. It was the headquarters of this particular FHA branch or whatever. And it was in the morning, and this approval person, happened to be a woman, had all of her doors and windows open. So she could easily be heard and was heard and saw by, you know, the other people in the office or the other people in the department. She had a big pile of folders on her desk to go over. Ours was the first one. We were on top. And she opened it up and saw the name PMH Atwater. And she screamed. She didn't yell. She screamed, PMH Atwater. She's famous. I read her book. Approved. She never read our file.
Oh.
She never read it. Because she had read Coming Back to Life, she approved our mortgage.
Talk about divine intervention.
Yeah, isn't
that
something? And the second most incredible thing that happened because of that book is that I had tens of thousands, and that is not an exaggeration, of people who came to me in the years afterward and said to me, your book, Coming Back to Life, saved my life.
Yes. I don't question that for a moment.
And, you know, that made all of the pain and all of the problems and all the depression. I won't say necessarily that it made it worthwhile. What it did was it took all of the tension and pain away. And
well, that's what it did for me, too, because I remember, again, being a closet in the ear. In fact, that may have indeed been the book that, because of seeing so many similarities, it, in a sense, gave me permission. Well, it and you know, connecting with you, all of this has really helped me and I think enabled me to come out and to say, well, if she could do it, then all right, I can too. And it really, because I hadn't been able to really compare notes with anybody else. And you, seeing this, reading that book and talking to you, I just thought, blimey, there's so many similarities here. So that really helped empower me too. And I'm not in the least bit surprised that that book has just done wonders for so many people. Now, do I remember this correctly, that this has been your best-selling book?
It's been our best-selling book in the numbers of copies that have sold.
Mm-hmm.
It's sold about 80,000 copies.
Wow.
Now, that's really not that many copies. In the publishing world, you have to sell over 100,000 copies in order for them to say it was worth their while publishing it, and that they made back their expenses, and they were now in the profit line, and it was a good book. So I never made it to that magic number of 100,000, but I did do 80,000. And none of the rest of them sold quite that much. Beyond the Light sold maybe 60, 65,000. And the rest of them have been less than that. I don't know why. I'm hoping that the big book of near-death experiences will really bring those numbers up. And who knows, maybe Coming Back to Life will revalidate itself and do great numbers again. Those people who do read it come away with a very different point of view of me, the work, near-death experiences, and that entire genre.
And how long has the new edition been out?
A few weeks.
Sorry.
Not too long. I think it came out last month or maybe the month before that. I'm not sure, but it's just been out weeks is all.
So what was it that compelled you to revise it?
An offer. An offer I got from Transpersonal Publishing, which is owned and run by Dee and Alan Chips.
Hello,
they have a school on hypnotism.
Yes.
And specializing in past life regressions and all the different applications of hypnosis. They run a school that certifies, legally and fully certifies people in hypnosis. So they run a lot of different classes, a lot of different degrees and certificates that you can get. And I don't know why they came to me, but they did. And you'd have to ask them why. But they did. And they said that they now have a book publishing arm or department to their company and their university. And they would like to bring back, not only Coming Back to Life, but next year, Beyond the Light.
Oh, excellent.
Which was a really, really, really in-depth book with a big resource section. And what they've done is they've taken the resource section from, I think it's from Beyond the Light or a book like that, and they've taken the old resource section out of Coming Back to Life and put that newer one in it. So you're going to get a newer resource section in Coming Back to Life. You also have a new introduction, but it is the idea that the old book is back. It is back, and then next year they bring back Beyond the Light.
Well, one thing I think is interesting, when I was talking to Dee yesterday, she was talking about the hypnosis that they work with also involves the life between lives, and I know that as NDEers, we're walking examples of, life on the other side, experiencing that, and the validity of the afterlife and being multidimensional. So I'm not really surprised that they would have approached you, and you make things so clear. And again, as I shared with you in the email, I think that being an experiencer as well as a researcher really enables you, us, to have a much broader perspective, not just, an academic hypothesis, but, okay, I've been here, and it gives us a much broader perspective on the truth of all of this. So
Well, also the fact that I was a field worker.
Yes.
I'm not a literary researcher. I'm a field worker. I'm right out there on the point with the people, with their families, with their loved ones, with their health care providers. And I want to know what's really going on. And if you're going to talk about the near-death experience, you must also talk about the after effects.
Yes,
because
indeed.
It's the after effects that validate the experience, not the other way around.
I think so, too.
And that's what I wanted to know. Okay, you've been to heaven. Show me what difference that has made in your life. So I was there to find out the other half of the story, and that's what I've been writing about a lot. But also with the experience itself, because I was never influenced at all by Raymond Moody, never heard of the guy when I first started. And the book Life After Life, never heard of that either.
Yeah.
And so my research took me in a little bit different direction and certainly enabled me to look in different eyes. So in some ways, my research challenges what we now know, and in other ways, it enables us to take a broader perspective coming from a different point of view.
Yes.
And my point of view is the people. And I'm not saying theirs wasn't. I'm saying mine is the people, not questionnaires. The
exactly.
people.
Yeah, because you interacted with them on a very deep level. And, something that's interesting, too, is that both Drs. Peter Finnick and Pim Van Lommel have spoken about the fact that, unlike hallucinations or anything like that, that the NDE, and this was their specific point, people do have after effects. People are altered forever from having had a near-death episode as opposed to a hallucination.
And some of them are permanent neurological changes.
Yes.
So we're not talking about little changes here, like change of attitude. We're talking about big things.
Yeah.
And, I want to step in here and make this announcement. I think your audience already has sort of put two and two together to get four, but I want to make this announcement anyway. Because of four large clinical prospective studies done in three countries and a plethora of papers now published in a number of different peer-reviewed journals, the near-death experience is now today the number one choice of scientists worldwide to study consciousness itself. Things like out-of-body experiences, the dead come back, visitors from the other side, otherworldly journeys, are no longer relegated to things like anoxia, oxygen deprivation, the dying brain, hallucinations. We now know that these types of things are normal and natural to the experience. And because of that, I remind everybody, this changes the conversation.
Yes.
The near-death field has taken this dramatic turn in the last 2 years. It's not the same field it used to be. And all of that is in the big book of near-death experiences. And I'm really pleading, I'm really asking, I'm even begging all of your listening audience, please get this book in the hospitals, in the clinics, in your doctor's offices, everywhere you can. Everywhere you possibly can. Because we now have a different field. We have so much research. We have so much that has been verified. And we really need that broader perspective. So let's get that book out there. And if any of your listeners are members of IANS, which is the International Association for Near-Death Studies, if you go to a group, if you're a member of an IANS group, any IANS group can order this book as a group from the publisher and get a 50% discount. Therefore, you can sell it, you can earn money, you can have a fundraising project, use this book from the sales that you make. Also, Mother IANS headquarters gets a 50% profit on all royalties. They get a cut, 50% on all royalties. In 5 years, they will own the book. I am very clear about this. Yes, I wrote this book. Yes, I did all that research. Yes, it was a lot of work. But that book does not belong to me. That book belongs to the readership. And my way of honoring the readership is to consider IANS a co-author. And eventually, someday, about 2013, they will be the author.
Well, that's really an example of someone who's dedicated to service and to sharing the truth. And I should let our listeners know that the big book of near-death experiences is actually an encyclopedia, a brilliant encyclopedia about NDEs. And I absolutely love it. It is on my website, too, towardthelight.org. But I think I'm going to jump on this and also get some copies to sell through Toward the Light.
Sure, it's 50% off, my dear.
Yes, okay.
If you're an IANS group, it's 50% off. Make yourself some money here.
Light with yourself, for me, it's more important to get the word out.
Yeah. You still need money to pay the bills, and this is a way of win-win.
Yes,
everybody
indeed.
Wins.
Something very strange that happened, PMH, that I'd like you to comment on, because you're talking about this new development in regards with the field and research of NDEs, that it's now the number one source for scientific study. I was on the teleconference with the Friends of IANS support and interest group meeting facilitators last Tuesday. And they've been talking about having panels of three or four NDEers giving presentations at different educational centers, universities, what have you.
Well, that sounds good.
And I think it's interesting, too, because, of course, that has been very popular at the IANS annual conferences here in America.
Mm-hmm.
But what was interesting is that one of the participants said that when she presented it to, and I don't recall which institution she was referring to, she said that they declined, said, oh, no, that's too controversial. And I just about fell over. I thought, after all these years, the topic of the NDE and death and dying are still considered controversial?
Tell her to take the big book of near-death experiences in with her to present to these people. Also tell her there are now over 100 medical schools that teach classes on the near-death experience. Also tell her that Mayo Clinic School of Medicine now requires all first-year students to take a class on the near-death experience.
Actually,
so apparently she didn't know how the field has shifted.
Actually, that was discussed during the meeting. I remember somebody mentioning that very thing, and I thought, oh, this is exciting, because I've got a client in Phoenix who's a medical student, and they're trying to get me to come out there and give a presentation. And he told me that in medical school, they only dedicate one afternoon in all the years of medical study, one afternoon on death and dying. I said, this
is crazy. So some of the schools are still backward, but there is a groundswell of these medical colleges that are now opening up. So let's take advantage of that. The door is open. And it's going to take us, it's going to take all of us to educate the public. We really must all do that. And that's our job now, is to educate the public about how things have changed. This is no longer the light at the end of the tunnel. By the way, that's mostly a myth.
Yes,
there's not that many people that experience a tunnel. We now know that the average timeout, as we say in research, without vital signs, no brain waves, no breath, no heartbeat, is from 5 to 20 minutes. That's average. That's not unusual. That's average. Of course, we know medically that the brain has to have oxygen in about 3 to 4 minutes, or there's retardation and various kinds of problems. A signature feature of the near-death experience, not the tunnels. The tunnels are not a signature feature at all.
I agree.
This is a signature feature, that not only is there little or no brain damage when they revive or are resuscitated, they come back smarter than they were before. There is actually brain enhancement, some to the point of genius, especially with children. So, you know, all we have to do now is come in with the evidence.
And that's such an important point, too, because that's something I have tried to share with people, is the fact that, as you so rightly said, too, people are completely rewired after a near-death episode. And again, there's that a marked difference between that and a hallucination or what have you, because these changes do not occur with just a mere hallucination or a dying brain. I can't believe how the likes of Susan Blackmore, she really needs help, bless her, are still trying to insist that this is all the product of a dying brain, but she doesn't even apply common
sense. Well, she doesn't take into consideration all of the research. She just hangs on a couple of pieces.
Yes.
Like, for instance, what she says calls the tunnel. Well, hey, not that many people experience a tunnel. So, you know, it's like she's wasting her breath here.
Yes, it is. Now, there's a good question for you. Do you happen to know the percentage of people who experience the tunnel? Because I know in all of my near-death states, I never had the tunnel experience ever.
In my research base, which is nearly 4,000, it was less than a third.
Wow. That's a small amount.
In those people who claim large percentages, those are the researchers who stick with just one hospital or who are researching near-death groups like IANS. You don't find it in the general population. We can trace all of the reports, not all of them, most of the reports of the tunnel back to the media sensationalizing Raymond Moody's first book, Life After Life. That doesn't mean that near-death experiencers are lying. It does mean that near-death experiencers are really lost for words. How do you describe what you witnessed, what you experienced, what you went through? And all of a sudden now they've got a word they've never thought of before, never had before, and it's a word that is used thanks to Raymond Moody and Life After Life. And it's not a word that he made up, but it was a word that he thought was appropriate to describe some of what people were saying. And so there's innocence on all ends here.
Sure.
What we're dealing with is the sensationalization of the near-death experience. And that has distorted some of the facts and the patterning. You know, the classical pattern, classical model of the near-death experience is not classical. We know that now. And so, you know, that just changes everything. If you're going to look at the experience and what are the most common elements found in a near-death experience, number one is out-of-body experiences. Hands down, out-of-body, number one. Number two is that incredible light. It's not like a flashlight or a light bulb or a really, really bright light. Most experiencers describe it as brighter than a million suns. A light that knows your name, a light that is intelligent, a light that is pure love. So this is a very different kind of light. And number three would be a greeter of some kind. And this is very common as well. And that includes animals. You're not just met by loved ones who've died and gone on before. You can be met by pets who've died and gone on before, or various arrangement of critters, as well as people, beings of various kinds, not just loved ones. They can be religious figures. They can be bright ones, as they're often called. Angels, different kinds of beings. If you live in Thailand, you are the most often met in your near-death experience by a Yamatut. A Yamatut is the servant of the Lord Yama, Lord of the Underworld. So they're called by different names in different places. One of the things that has interested me is that if I'm doing cross-cultural work, and I have done some, I'll have them draw what they saw. And you can't tell the difference in the drawings between a person from Kenya, Palestine, Russia, or the state of Wyoming. You know? It's still this same incredible greeter, no matter what color, what form, whoever we call that person. It's either a loved one or some incredible greeter. The out-of-body experience is still beyond anything that most of us can imagine as an out-of-body experience. And then, of course, that incredible light. And when we're talking about lights, there are clearly three different types of lights experiencers see. They don't all see this bright white light, not at all. Many of them see a light that is so bright, like a million suns, maybe 2 million suns, that it actually almost hurts to look at it. It's very raw, very piercing, very powerful. Doesn't seem to have any particular color, except that it's very luminous. And very luminous. Then there is the dark or black light. No, this doesn't have anything to do with hell or anything that's negative. Most experiencers, especially children, describe this light as being very warm, very healing, very safe, very intelligent. Its job, it seems, is to have a lot to do with healing and with the intelligence factor, the brain, and how it functions. Then there, and very often this black or dark light is described as having purple in it, very dark purple, beautiful, luminous purple in it.
And you've also described that as being the feminine aspect of the light.
I was going to get to that in a minute.
Okay.
And the third one is the white or yellow gold light, or a white bright light with yellow gold tinges. And this is the one where you see the greatest faculty enhancements. People talk the most about how loved they were in this light, very much an unconditional love. And it's the children, who really, I think, labeled these lights better than anybody I know. The kids call that dark light or black light the darkness that knows. This light knows things. And the kids are very specific. They say, well, that very raw, piercing light, that very, very super, super powerful light, that's God's light. And this dark light, that's mother light. And this very bright white light, that's father light. And that the father light and the mother light come from God's light. So I just find that incredible. You know, it's just, I think the kids have something on all of us.
Yes, they're really brilliant, and they haven't had, as you point out, time to be influenced by culture or society or life events and what have you. And I know for me that it was kind of interesting too, that I found the light to be all-encompassing. It didn't seem to be directional.
No, it's not. None of the three are. They're very definitely all-encompassing. And I find it very fascinating as a researcher, whether adult or child, some of the most miraculous cures that we hear of are usually done in this black or dark light. It seems to be very much a healing light. You know, you hear people dying of a cancer or brain tumor. And if they're enveloped with this black or dark light, invariably that cancer or that tumor is gone. And interestingly enough, it doesn't come back.
I think that's a very important point to make, because there's so many things, you know, people ask, oh, how did you come back? How is it that you're still alive? And I often refer to the spontaneous recovery that actually was a result of the light, of that unconditional love, and had nothing whatever to do with anyone in the medical establishment. None.
Yeah.
Now, of course, I'm doing everything I can to take care of myself. I'm not going to be frivolous and all of that. But, you know, the love in this part is what's so ineffable. I'm sorry that unconditional love has become such a cliche, but there just is nothing like it. And once you go through it, then you know it.
Yeah.
It is not something that can be hypothesized. But there's an incredible power in that love and in the light that we experience. And also the good news.
Well, you know, when we're talking about near-death experiences, I think it's only proper and I think it's only good to also talk about those that are frightening.
Yes.
And those that are scary and uncomfortable and hellish, because those are just as real as the more heavenly ones are. And there are a lot of people that have these kinds of experiences. In my research base, it was 1 out of 7. In the research base of Dr. Maurice Rawlings, 1 out of 5. I truly feel that closer to 1/3 of the experiencers have the more difficult or scary or uncomfortable near-death experience. And I say that large of a figure, 1/3, because most of the people who have these kinds of experiences are either afraid, embarrassed, or for whatever reason don't want to talk about them. And they won't come forward. And the reason they came forward to me, lots of them did, lots more than I ever counted, is because, well, you know, I ask them. I ask a number of them why they were coming to me and not going to someone else. And they all said principally the same thing. You're an experiencer. You know the truth. I know you'll listen to me, and I'll tell you my story.
And there's a good point right there, PMH, and that's why I said that at the beginning of the show, because you are an experiencer as well as a researcher. And I'm going to take it a little step further, that I think part of the fact that you are a female and a very nurturing one at that also makes you more approachable to these people.
Well, I tend to be a little scruffy, too. Let's not get too syrupy here. I tend to get a little scruffy.
Well, you're a Virgo.
And some people appreciate that. You know, I'd like to quote Dr. Alan Keller here. He's one of our really great researchers in cross-cultural studies.
Mm.
And he's just finding some incredible things, he and a lot of other people as well. And he said this. He said, all features of the near-death experience suggest an urgent need in society to include the extraordinary. And, you know, to me, that just speaks with thunder. There is an urgent need in society to include the extraordinary. This is just so true. You know, we're getting closer and closer with this major shift in near-death studies. We now have the scientific examination, the field of psychism, synchronicity, of the chaos theory. You know, science now is branching out into a scientific study of a lot of things we used to call woo-woo.
Yeah.
And they're finding, wait a minute here, we got to look at this stuff. And it was the physicist Wolfgang Pauli who decreed, and I want to quote him, a new science is needed to explore the objective side of human consciousness and the subjective side of matter, not mysticism, but a science willing to incorporate objective and subjective avenues to discovery while recognizing the legitimacy of personal experience. You know, we're on the edge of that. We're almost there. Society, the world, we're almost there.
Well, I think a very important point, too, is the fact that, again, too, the thing like the near-death experience, out-of-body experience, spiritually transformative experiences, all of this is pointing the fact, or to the fact, that we do not reside in a merely five-sensory, itty-bitty little reality. In fact, that's not what I would call reality at all, far from, but as has been pointed out, we are interdimensional.
Well, all of our faculties are expansive. They're very expanded and accelerated. This is what happens in these experiences. Our faculties expand. Well, they used to be that way a long time ago. Our faculties, what we call psychism as well, or the psychic abilities, all of that is just survival abilities. We've had it trained out of us.
Yeah.
As we became industrialized and were taught in schools, we considered this kind of thing to be pagan or, you know, unworthy or less than. So we moved ourselves away from this whole other greater reality that is being recognized now today as really true and valid. So we're going back now to what we had, or I should say our forebears had, and realizing that that stuff was really true. And that we're now able to go back as scientists and really stretch it and experiment with it and find out, whoops, you know, there really is something to this. It really does work. So when we're saying, you know, our five senses are maybe very limited. They're only limited because we have made them so or we're convinced that they were so. They are not limited. They never were limited. What we call psychic abilities are simply survival abilities.
Hmm.
And once you begin to accelerate and expand these abilities, and that's what happens after a near-death experience, if you weren't psychic before, you become psychic after. If you were psychic before, you become very psychic after. And it's not because of psychism. It's because faculties normal to us expand and accelerate and enlarge. So that all of a sudden, we have what we think are new abilities when they're not new abilities. They are expansions of abilities and faculties normal to us.
Very good. That's what I've been saying, too, that they've just been reawakened or re-quickened, as it were, because that is a very natural part of our being.
It is natural.
Mm.
If you're breathing, you're psychic.
There you go. Thank you. We've got just a couple of minutes left. Do you have any announcements or anything coming up that you would like to share with our listeners?
Well, for those in the Virginia Beach area, I will be at the ARE, which is the Association for Research and Enlightenment, and I'll be sharing the stage with Dan Millman in a seminar on one's purpose in life, and it's the 15th, 16th, and 17th of August. So I will be there then, and I would just invite people to get on my website, find out where I'm going to be, and hopefully maybe in your area. Or if you want me in your area, just let me know. And my website, again, is www.pmhatwater.com.
Well, this is wonderful, and I look forward to seeing you next week.
Well, yes, I finally get to see you physically because you moved to that area.
Yeah, so next week, what am I saying? Next month in August, that is going to be tremendous. And then I'm also going to be speaking there, same location at the Virginia Beach IAMS meeting on the 6th. September. So this is very exciting to me, and I'm really looking forward to your being here. And I'm assuming, am I right, that you will have copies of some of your books available for people?
They are available at the bookstore.
Oh, okay.
ARA Bookstore is a good source of my material, but also any bookstore. And certainly Amazon.com as well. If you want a discount, it's Amazon.com. If you want to pay just the regular price, it's my own bookstore on my website. Of course, with me, you get an autograph if you get it from me. But you can get any of my books at any bookstore. If they don't have them, they can order them.
I actually look forward to people seeing the revised edition of Coming Back to Life, because I remember reading it, and it moved me to bits. And again, I dare say that it really helped me to be able to move forward and to just say, all right, I'm an NDE and here I am ready to do this work.
Well, that's the most basic and most intimate and most raw of all of my books.
It's beautiful, though. It's a lovely, lovely, wonderful book. And it, as I said, it moved me. And then the wonderful encyclopedia, as I prefer to call it, the big book of near-death experiences. This is tremendous. PMH, it's been so wonderful, of course, having you back on Toward the Light. And it was you that joined me for the debut of Toward the Light. So I've got much gratitude towards you, lots of love. And I want to tell everyone you've been listening to Toward the Light, Leading Back to the Source. And I want to remind you that it is only with the heart that one can see rightly. What is essential is invisible to the eye. Please remember that only love prevails. We are going to have Thomas Vieira on next week's transmission of Toward the Light, so please do join us then. Lots of love and blessings to everyone. Thank you for joining us. We will speak to you next week.
Where would $5,000 per week take you? Discover the exact details of a simple and proven system that quickly puts $5,000 to $10,000 in many students' pockets every week. What's most amazing is that there are almost no computer skills required, and you can start pulling in cash automatically within just a few hours. We are absolutely convinced that our proven system will create massive wealth for virtually anyone, and we'll prove it. Go to bbscashflow.com now and get all the details. That's bbscashflow.com.